A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, you're very welcome along to this week's episode of the Group Chat Podcast. I'm news correspondent Zara King, and I'm joined in studio by political correspondent Gavin Riley.
Hi, Zara.
And my fellow news correspondent Richard Chambers.
Hiya.
How are you?
Good, yeah.
It's been an interesting couple of days. The last time you would have heard from the Group Chat was obviously for the bonus episode, which we released on Friday. Richard, I'm going to come straight to you because you are now working on a special report on what happened last Thursday. You've been filming quite a lot and looking at it in depth. Sort of bring us up to speed about what's happened since we last spoke to listeners.
Well, I suppose the obvious starting point is actually with the condition of the people who were attacked outside the school, Gaelscoil Coláiste de Mhuire on Parnell Square East. The 5-year-old girl who was critically injured in that attack, as of recording on Wednesday, still in a critical condition. So she's still fighting for her life in hospital. There was some indication that she'd stabilised a little bit, but she is still in a very precarious situation. Mm-hmm. So our thoughts are obviously with her and her family. Her carer, who was also stabbed, is still in hospital. And the person of interest in this case is still under guard in hospital. His condition is not critical, but the nature of his injuries, which do include head injuries, we understand, mean it's probably going to be a matter of possibly into weeks before Gardaí can actually properly hold an interview, although that needs to be monitored and that could be something which changed. So that's where we're at with regards to the stabbing, which started all this. And then in terms of the rioting, which materialised off the back of that, it's really difficult to get a grip on where you actually start with the investigation into that, because there's the actual disorder and all the rioting and the violence that we did see on the night. Mm-hmm. There's also the investigation into, well, how did that get started? And all of that we'll be focusing on the online element, which I'm sure we'll come to in a little bit. Mm-hmm. But there's hundreds and thousands of hours of CCTV footage which is being trawled through at this point. I'm sure for listeners and people who have been around Dublin over the last couple of days and weeks as well, or days since the riot, which will, you know, effectively when you're listening to this as a podcast, it's a week on effectively.
Yeah, it will be, yeah.
It's kind of hard to get your head around everything because so much of the damage was immediately covered up. Like in terms of repaired, the tarmacking was done on O'Connell Street almost immediately.
Which is the credit is actually the council workers, which I think is kind of, you know, to acknowledge that how quickly they were on the scene the next day and really got the city back up on its feet to a degree.
Yeah, a lot of the shops have now been fully repaired. They've got the glass done. Mm. Some of them are still boarded up, have, you know, plywood and whatever on their windows. But the scars from what happened last Thursday are, you know, we actually don't know the extent of them yet. Yeah. Because I think it's very obvious now, though, to anybody who's even paid, you know, passing attention to the news and social media, that we're in a very dangerous place now. And it's a place we should have seen coming. Many people have, you know, raised the alarm about this going back a long time. But we are now in uncharted territory in this country in terms of what we saw last Thursday, the implications of it, and what it could inspire going forward as well.
Politically, Gavin, calls now for the Justice Minister to resign or to be removed from her post.
Yeah, which the government will obviously hold out against, but at the time of recording, we don't know this for certain, but it's now almost certain that Sinn Féin will use its dole time next Tuesday to table a motion of no confidence seeking to get rid of her, which will almost certainly be defeated by the government, but it is nonetheless the grandest gesture that an opposition party can do, saying you should sack the minister. And they've been saying in leaders' questions on Wednesday that because Helen McEntee hasn't ever formally acknowledged that for a few hours at least, the guards lost control of the main street and other areas of the capital city, and that's not on, and that you can't, if you can't acknowledge that, then you have no business staying in the job. Now, Helen McEntee, for her own part, says, well, we're doing all these other concrete things. We're making sure that the Gardaí are adequately resourced. You know, where I'm going away to check whether, make sure that they all feel comfortable in their use of batons, for example, because a lot of members of the guards anecdotally don't feel like they're comfortable doing that for fear of recriminations, that they might be thought of as having used excessive force. Some of the things she is doing, though, and it's worth pointing this out, and I understand why spin doctors would want to talk up things that they're already doing. You want to look like in a situation like this, you're making active, assertive, concrete
that you have control
things.
Of what's
you are offering some kind of a strong-armed response to what's going on. A lot of what has been announced and is shortly in train is stuff that was already happening. So the discussion, like, for example, around the guards being allowed to wear body cams, legislation finished its journey through the Dáil on Wednesday evening, was happening anyway. Helen McEnany and others now talking this up as a part of the government's response was already happening. Legislation to allow the use of facial recognition technology so that it's easier mm-hmm. in future to scan through all footage that you've got, CCTV and the likes, and identify people automatically without needing to do it manually was already happening. In fact, they wanted to do it in the body cams bill, and the Green Party said, not too easy about you doing those two things together at the same time.
So can I just pause for a second on that particular point, Richard, because that is the thing, isn't it, that's going to really, like Helen McEnany even said yesterday when she was speaking to reporters, that alone is something that's going to be cumbersome. Like, that's the thing that's going to take the most amount of time to identify individuals and then eventually have people arrested. She's admitted yesterday that it could take months for people to be brought to justice because of that exact point.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I look at it and I see all of the political ramifications of this, and here's what we're going to do to make sure this doesn't happen again. And none of what they're outlining is actually stuff which will prevent it happening again.
Mm.
Right?
Mm.
Everything that they're outlining is what happens when there is the next riot. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Everything is about, well, what will Gardaí be able to use? Will they be able to use force? Will they have, you know, proper equipment? What pepper spray will they have? Will they feel secure in using force? What sort of gear will they be wearing? Doesn't prevent the next riot. It's about what happens when the next riot actually happens.
But is there a certain inevitability to that, though?
I think obviously the far right...
I don't know the answer to that question, obviously, but it's to kind of consider...
There's inevitability that the far right is here and they are emboldened by what has happened. Literally, only a couple of nights ago, we saw Mary Lou McDonald again being heckled outside a meeting she was coming from in her constituency. Some of the people who are involved there, or some of the people who streamed that, were some of the people who have, you know, pushed online some of the talking points, which are widely shared by members of the far right. So that is something which is clearly, like, you know, we're going to see more and more agitation. We saw in Drumahaire in County Leitrim, people set up illegal checkpoints, effectively vigilante style, checking identifications of drivers because of concerns there locally around the use of a former hotel for asylum seekers. There's an emboldenment happening here. Now, not everybody involved would probably fit into the confines of what's known as the far right, but this is all spiraling off of what happened. And it is spiraling into an area where we can expect more issues arising out of this.
The one, just as a counterpoint to some of that, because I do agree that there probably will be an inevitability about there being some kind of display like this in future, it's probably worth distinguishing between the anti-immigrant nature of some of the people who instigated the disorder last Thursday and then some others who just opportunistically bailed into it because there was disorder and they wanted to...
Yeah, but I'm actually going to draw a line in this, because I actually think this is well overplayed. This is well overplayed. The riot wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for the far right.
No, that's true.
And
no,
there's so many people who in politics have decided straight off the bat that you can't assign a political ideology for what happened. Mm. If it was just about lads who wanted to wreck Dublin, they would have wrecked Dublin any other night of the week.
The point I was just going to make was that the idea of having more pepper spray or more permissive use of batons and the likes is an attempt to disincentivize opportunistic lads who will hop onto somebody else's bandwagon.
Yeah.
But as you're right, it doesn't deal with the underlying political satisfaction.
It does grind the gears, because it's just like, if we've heard so much from politicians and from the Gardaí around who've defended their approach to how they've policed the far right over months and months and months in terms of, you know, violent incidences, the burning of tents, the firebombing of asylum centres. Mm. This has been coming for so long. And they've defended their approach, and now they've got to a point where now we've had a riot take over our streets of our capital for a long period of time. And now we've decided, or some people are trying to declare that it's not the far right, it's just lads. Like, when are we ever going to get to grips with the problem when we can't identify it?
Ridiculous. I think it's a ridiculous assertion. Mm. But sorry, continue the point you were going to make that I totally interrupted you in about 5 minutes ago.
No, but I can't remember what point that was.
Too many issues.
The point that just to crystallize the other point is that the idea of giving guards more resources to deal with future riots, yes, it presumes that more rioting will take place at some other point. But it's trying to deal with the opportunistic hangers-on, not the underlying cause. There is a big question, though, and you mentioned, you know, the policing response up till now. And this really does lead to the question, which hasn't gone away from the political ramifications of this in the last 6 or 7 days, which is, how do they not see it coming? Partly because of, as you rightly point out, Richard, the very hands-off approach to protests in libraries or the burning of Sandwith Street or a lot of the other things that have gone on, which have basically, the guards have taken a very hands-off approach of do not inflame, but they're still allowing people
to act. Is that the point of hands-off is like a de-escalation sort of, or is it that, you know...
Yeah.
There's, like, you can see that there was a logic probably to that to some degree.
Yeah, and I know for certain that it's a direct, specific response to what they now recognise as the over-policing of water charges protests. Oh, like, for example, where the Gardaí went in some cases, hammer and tongs, using the sort of assertiveness that really wasn't required in the situation and ended up making martyrs of some people and actually inflaming an awful lot of circumstances that really could have been downplayed had they gone in with a more gently approach. So they tried to learn from that, but now they've gone in with a situation where they've been very hands-off on stuff which is clearly objectionable, like protests at libraries, harassing of library staff, the burning of asylum seekers' belongings on side streets in Dublin within a stone's throw of Leinster House. And now we are where we are. And moreover, and Richard, you allude to this, because I know you were there and you saw Mary Lou McDonald arrive on Thursday afternoon to the site, and she's a constituency TD, so you know she shows up. But how immediately evident it was to anyone who was there, whether it be reporters like yourselves or politicians that showed up, that there was already going to be something of a sinister response to all of this. Mm. And it was very obvious on Telegram channels that, as I mentioned last week, the guards do watch, because that's how they knew there was going to be a protest in mid-September at Leinster House. No one rang up Pier Street and said, by the way, lads, we're on our way down. The guards just saw it coming because they monitor these things. If you monitor those things, if you open TikTok, and you've seen people doing live streams on the For You page in the last few weeks, following on from the murder of Aisling Murphy and the sentencing of Yosef Pushka, and people talking about how there's a need to clamp down on immigration in the country. How did you not see it coming? How did you not know that all it needed was one lightning rod for the whole thing to boil over? And how do they not see that last Thursday was going to be it?
Maybe they didn't literally have enough people to cover it. And maybe it goes back to the root point that the Garda Representative Association have been making, and even the Dáil Éireadh to the Mayor has been making, about that you're policing the capital essentially on overtime, that you're relying on, you know, people coming forward and doing extra hours. And that maybe actually this thing that we've been talking about for months and months and months, when we think back to the attack on Stephen Termini and we talked about the capital not having enough resources. Mm-hmm. Like, it's all well and good to have the intelligence and say, yeah, look, we know this is going to happen. But if you don't actually have the boots to put on the ground, well, then you're kind of leaving yourself vulnerable.
Yeah, I agree. And resourcing and numbers is obviously a part of it. But it's the response itself was, I mean, we hear about it in the documentary as well, that there's a growing view that it was just wholly inadequate in terms of what actually arrived and when it arrived. Because, as you say, Gavin, and it wasn't just on Telegram. This wasn't on some like nebulous, you know, app which nobody has. It was on Twitter. Which is where people were telling people to come down to the spire. People were declaring that Ireland was at war all the way throughout the afternoon. Mm. If you are already there and you're at the scene and you have senior Gardaí who are at the scene as well, and they are being abused very, very vociferously, and you had for a period of a couple of hours perhaps before the riot actually started, Gardaí being jostled at the cordon.
Well, said, surely, surely the guards of the cordon knew that the turn that things were taking, and then ought to have fed that back up the food chain and some decision they made. So if it is the case that the resources were just inadequate or that there aren't enough bodies on the ground, that's where then the question mark over Helen McEntee's future comes in, because it's a little bit like housing, where Dara O'Brien says, yeah, like, I know the situation is rough, but like, we're investing like no one's ever done before. We're now building more houses than have been done for 20 years and producing all these metrics that show progress. Progress isn't enough progress if there's still a bigger problem that you're not dealing with. Like, you can build more and more houses, but if there's more and more people homeless, then you're underperforming. And the same thing can be said of Helen McEntee, in that, yes, you've made sure there's more guards.
Yeah.
But if you're still running to catch up, you haven't done enough.
But even the more guards thing was interesting. So yesterday, Helen McEntee was saying there's like 27 new guards going through Templemore. And I was thinking, like, 27 is like nothing. 27 extra people on O'Connell Street last week wouldn't have, like, I mean, it would have been helpful, but I don't know if 27 would have been.
Probably would. If they were all public order guards, they might have done a job, because that's at the end of it.
These are 27 newbies coming out of college who are just starting out. Like, you can put a lot of emphasis on the expertise and experience of somebody who's been in policing for many, many years. You know, a new graduate, you know, with the greatest respect, it's exciting, they come out of college, they come in with good intentions, and they work hard, of course. But the difference between somebody who has that boots on the ground experience and knows what to look out for and is sharp, and as you say, Richard, has perhaps done, you know, training to be in the various different units.
Which is
very
stepped up, by the way, that more members.
That's
a very different Garda as an individual.
You know what I mean? That's a very different person that you're sending out on that job, on that policing operation. So, you know, 27 new people coming out of college, I don't like, I, of course we need people to keep coming, but I just, you know, I don't know if that's necessarily, as you say, Richard, the answer.
It's definitely part of how you have to keep people safe in it, because Dublin was not safe. And it wasn't safe again on Friday, even though Gardaí took a much more proactive response to it. Conor Lally, the crime and security editor of the Irish Times, in a piece today, he quotes an experienced Dublin-based Gardaí who says, "We've been overly tolerant of some of these far-right people, and that probably started during the pandemic. A core group of them were roaming all over the country looking for a rise out of us. The instruction was not to engage, not to steam in and arrest people, because we didn't want disturbances kicking off. But that's only emboldened them. And I think some of our own people, i.e. the guards, maybe got used to that style of policing, doing everything you could to avoid stepping forward and confronting these characters." So, like, you can only tackle the problem when you admit that there's a problem. And I think that until everybody sort of agrees that, you know, what we're dealing with here is a group which we're struggling to actually understand as a political and, you know, the authorities as an establishment, you can't really address it. And now I think there is probably a growing consensus, like how dangerous this grouping is, this loose affiliated grouping is. But there are serious question marks being asked within the Gardaí about the instructions which their members have given been given over the last number of months, that this idea, as you say, Gavin, and like, don't give them what they want, don't make martyrs out of anybody. Well, if you don't make martyrs out of anybody, they'll continue to think they can get away with everything. And they did get away with absolutely everything last Thursday night. I want to pause on the social media element of this as well, because this is something which is now being investigated in terms of incitement and how this riot happened, how people were brought on, whether they be people who are involved in anti-immigration or who are involved in the far right, plus then other people who opportunistically thought there'd be trouble and would kick off as well as part of that. So they're looking at, obviously, a lot of postings which would have taken, a lot of people will have seen some of these postings. For example, you know, voice messages saying, let's go out there and just kill the foreigners, kill the immigrants, which is very, very, you know, that was widely shared across international media. So they're looking at all these things. They're looking at a couple of high profile people who will have shared some of this material online. But there's a big problem which has sort of been allowed to fester online. That is, Twitter.com has become, I think, effectively, well, Elon Musk, right? The owner of Twitter.com pays Tucker Carlson money to do his show. This is a former Fox News guy. He now does a show exclusively on X or Twitter. And he was chatting away to Steve Bannon, whom people might remember was a senior advisor to Donald Trump, saying that Ireland is replacing the Irish population with people from the third world. And this has actively been pushed out by Twitter.com. Anybody who doesn't follow anybody from the far right will have seen far right talking points on the For You tab. People with blue ticks, that's how they get extra views. I really don't understand, you know, it's not a place where you can do news properly anymore, I don't think.
I stopped doing news there nearly a year, I'd say over a year ago now. I don't really share anything.
It's a dangerous, dangerous place. Like, all this
monitor, as you say, it's a monitoring space to monitor what's happening so that you're not totally oblivious. But I rarely tweet. I don't think I've tweeted.
I can understand why you wouldn't want to be around there anymore, because some of the stuff, like the personalized abuse that we get in replies now routinely, is not ideal. But I know that's not the real point. But I sort of fear that if we all just decide wholesale to abandon it, given how populated the platform is, that you're just surrendering the entire playing field.
But what if it's not worth it, is the point. And I accept there'll be.
But there's so many civilian users that are still there.
Most people don't use Twitter, though.
No, most people don't. But still, a large number of the everyday users who are our audience 5, 10, 15 years ago.
Absolutely, yeah.
Still there.
I know, and there'll be different viewpoints on it, and they're all legitimate. But I think that you're giving a legitimacy to the site, which is now funneling people towards complete lies, complete conspiracy theories, and is charging people for the benefit of funding more of these things, which is downright dangerous. And it has absolutely played a role. That website played an absolute role in the burning of our capital city's main thoroughfare, the attacks on immigrants. It has been a really, really, really dangerous pool. And I think we've seen other media organisations around the world completely step off it. Like Australian news organisations stepped off. We can't legitimise this anymore. We are only bringing more people to it, because there will be good people and there will be people who put out good information on Twitter. But the problem is, anybody who goes on there looking for good information is still going to be subjected to all the bad information. And you are doing just as much to sort of keep eyes on muck, lies, slander, defamation, hate speech, and outright instigation now of, you know, riots.
Riots. I do take your point, though. I do take your point that, you know, you have to be the voice of reason among some of that. And I understand that there has to be somebody there who does that.
Because if the only news, like, if you, in the same way that, like, a lot of people don't, people of our generation commonly don't get news from Facebook now, and Facebook has almost kind of become something of a wasteland where people in of older generations are fed nonsense by bad faith actors. Yeah. That if we all just abandon Twitter, X, whatever algebraic function it is today, that we're kind of doing the same thing to a much more prominent platform from which people usually harvest their news. Well, although as a counterpoint to that, Helen McAtee did say in the Dáil Chamber on Wednesday, she was asked again about, you know, how come you didn't see this coming? And she said that the guards were monitoring all of these platforms and that they had ongoing contact with TikTok, regularly accused of possibly being an agent of misinformation, but that when the guards said, hey, that material's inflammatory, TikTok was down straight away. They had ongoing contact with Meta, the publishers of Facebook and of Instagram. Anything objectionable, taken down straight away. X, the publishers of Twitter.com, did not take material down. But Helen McAtee said that they specifically allowed stuff which is even against their own terms of service, let alone removing stuff that the guards thought was some sort of incitement to hatred or might have been actually criminal content. X did not cooperate in taking it down, which is an interesting bellwether of where we are.
Is that you off the tweets then? Are you just going to monitor?
Yeah, I think it's just monitoring now. I just don't think I can, in good conscience, contribute there anymore. I don't think, I think, you know, again, as I say, I just feel like you're just sort of swimming upstream. You can put out good information. People will distort it. People will get the For You tab, which will push the views and the outright lies of people who, for example, on Thursday said that a man went into a school, a foreign man went into a school and stabbed five kids and they all died, which is an outright lie. This is what's been published. This is what's been pushed. Elon Musk himself knows exactly what he's doing. And I think that it's not worth us giving credence or legitimacy to a website which does not care about facts, it does not care about good information, and it does not care what damage it does.
Okay, Richard Chambers steps back from X.
That'll so it actually means, on a lighter note, my last ever post on Twitter is a retweet of Godzilla, and it looks like he's in front of a microphone, and somebody said, so glad they finally got Godzilla on a podcast. So there you go. That is my last footnote in there.
Mic drop.
Before we go, being, the documentary's out Thursday night?
Thursday night, 10:15, Dublin on Fire. So it's basically a timeline of everything that happened over the course of the day, some insight from people who are affected by it, and sort of a look, a starting look at some of the bigger root causes of everything that happened.
So hopefully most of you who are listening will have heard the good news in terms of Emily Hand. She was released from captivity inside Gaza over the weekend. It was on Saturday night, actually. So obviously this is wonderful news for her father, Tom, who we had on the podcast and Tom spoke just a couple of weeks ago. You know, such a relief, I suppose, for everyone in a sense that, like, we have to remind people that Tom Hand had been told that Emily was dead initially and had expressed relief on that front because he had been so worried about what she might have experienced if she was a hostage inside Gaza. And then to learn weeks later that actually she was still alive and inside Gaza, and to come to terms with all of that, and then to have gone on that sort of journey to Ireland, the UK and the States looking for support to have the released hostages. So really, really good news for family. And I think a lot of people probably have seen the clip. And if you haven't, it's on, I think all of us have on our social media, is the clip of them being reunited over the weekend. But like, there's a long journey ahead of them now as a family in terms of Emily's recovery, in terms of, you know, helping her to deal with and process what she's been through. Tom Hand sat down with Clarissa Ward from CNN to talk about that reunion and how it went. And before we get into a chat about it, I just want to give people a quick listen to that clip now.
I thought she was in the tunnels, but she wasn't in the tunnels. They were actually fleeing from house to house. She doesn't like it to be referred to as Gaza. She says the kufsa, the box. So you have to say, like, how long were you in the box? The kufsa. She said a year. So apart from the whispering, that was like a punch in the guts. She cried until her face was red and blotchy. She couldn't stop. She didn't want any comfort. I guess she's forgotten how to be comforted. I just had to wait until she came out of it by herself. And she knows how to do that. She's a very determined little girl, very strong.
So you just heard Tom talking about whispering there. So when Emily first came out, that, you know, she was so used to having to stay quiet and be quiet that in the environment that she was in, that her voice was just a really faint whisper. Gavin, you're a father of two little girls. I suppose you kind of hear that and think, you know, the idea of her concept of time being that she thought that she was there for a year.
That's the bit that actually punches me in the gut a bit, because I remember, like, when the news broke on Saturday night that she was out, and just the general, you could almost sense on certain cursed social networking sites that we won't refer to again, you could sense that kind of that sudden uplift in mood. Everyone's like, oh God, like, what a rare bit of good news after such weeks of just torrential, just bad news upon bad news upon bad news. And of course, there was always going to be a process of trying to, you know, overcome some of the things that emerge when you're in captivity for 7 weeks. But the idea that she thought she was there for a year, and just how much that's just a single fact that just illustrates the enormity, not just for the Hand family, but just for everyone involved in that. You know, for the people who now have been able to leave Gaza, you know, we were talking about the Alagas in previous weeks and some of what they've left behind, and how you're going to be dealing with that baggage for so long. And that's not just even for individual pockets. It's basically two whole societies. In one way or another, most people in Israeli society and everybody in Gaza and parts of the West Bank too, and other regions, they're all going to be living with the fallout of this. We're in the middle of a what's now 6 days of a ceasefire. Let's touch wood and hope that it's more. But even that much, like 6 weeks of all-out war, and just the damage that causes, and the scars that people carry with them then for their whole lives, which just completely changes how everything, everyone's lives will be run in that region forever. Like, you cannot begin to overstate that.
But it's the children, isn't it? It's the Palestinian children, it's the Israeli children, it's children we've heard so much about in all of this.
I think that's probably amongst the most shocking things about what has been just a grievous situation now for a number of weeks. Absolutely, heart goes out to the Hand family. Delighted Emily Hand has now been reunited with her dad. There are kids, the role of kids in this war and how kids have become almost the predominant victims in all of this is something which is very, even just looking at the news headlines there today. So a 14-year-old boy is one of those detainees who's been released from Israeli jails. Now, of course, if you're a 14-year-old trial, and most of these prisoners who've been released by Israel never got a trial. These were administratively put in to jail, taken from their family. So that's egregious as well. Two young kids, according to the Palestinian Authority, have been killed by gunfire in the West Bank city of Jenin, where Israel is carrying out an operation. More than 6,000 children have died in Gaza since the start of the war as well, plus all of those children who died in Israel in the Hamas attacks. All those kids who've been hostages as well. And it is absolutely just staggering when you try and see not just the amount of kids who have been shot, who have died in airstrikes, who have been taken hostage, who've died throughout, you know, there's probably kids who have died now as a result of the hospital failures as well. Plus all the kids now who've had to come back now, or who are walking away from this, and they will have a lifetime which they're impacted by everything.
Yeah.
Whether that be Emily, and, you know, again, wishing her all of the best in her life going forward. Mm-hmm. All of the kids from places like Ireland who've come back now home, after being allowed to evacuate from Gaza, but all of them will carry what's happened over the last number of weeks with them for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, and I think for a lot of people that mightn't have realised as well, because there was so much going on at the time. You know, Emily's birth mother died when she was 2.5. And it was Tom's first wife, who would be the mum of Emily's older brother and sister, kind of stepped in as a stepmum and was her mother figure. And that lady was murdered in the kibbutz on the 7th of October, on the day that Emily was abducted. So that all had to be delivered to Emily on foot of her coming out of captivity as well. Gavin, just to move to the political aspect of this, Leo Varadkar tweeted again, to bring up Twitter again. God, we can't avoid it.
Never tweet.
As much as you've tried to avoid it, Richard. Yeah. He did tweet at the time, and, you know, this has caused quite a stir.
The tweet that Leo Varadkar's account posted, because I don't think it was the man himself. I suspect it was some operative in his office, because it was verbatim. To go full Colleen Rooney on it.
Yeah.
Because the tweet was verbatim, the first paragraph of what was a much more nuanced 5-paragraph statement that Leo Varadkar had issued, where he fully acknowledged that this person who had been newly released, and by the way, worth recalling in these circumstances, an Irish citizen. Mm-hmm. So the apparent pretense that Leo Varadkar would somehow downplay an act of terrorism that resulted in an Irish citizen being kidnapped for 6 or 7 weeks is just bunkum anyway. Mm-hmm. But Leo Varadkar's statement recognised all of that, but in I guess what you might consider to be a slightly clumsy or ham-fisted attempt at being either poetic or trying to invoke some religious imagery, obviously in the first paragraph referred to Emily as having been lost and now being found. And this on...
Was that some sort of like Amazing Grace reference or
that
something?
That kind there? Of a thing. I think that there's a specific biblical verse which isn't Amazing Grace that was apparently that the attempt was to invoke that.
Right.
But because, anyway, it was only that first line that made it as far as a tweet, because Leo Varadkar then took some more time to screen grab the whole thing afterwards, took him a day to do it. This was taken up as being the entirety of his statement. And people in Israel said, hang on, why are you referring to her as only being lost? She was kidnapped. Why are you downplaying terrorism? Which, of course, was not the attempt at all, but the shorthand version of Twitter and the lack of nuance that it occurs meant that Sonia McGuinness, the Irish ambassador, had to go into the foreign ministry in Jerusalem on a few days that followed and get a bit of a scolding because Ireland was apparently not sympathetic enough to the fact that one of its own citizens had been kidnapped.
But it's not going away, Richard, really, is it?
Doesn't seem to be, but I mean, you would think from an Israeli government point of view, they have more like pressing issues than what the Irish government, almost irrelevant. To the situation has to do with it. It is. And it was actually always, you saw universally, I think, even amongst, you know, political rivals, Leo Varadkar here said, come on.
Yeah.
It was very obvious what he was doing there. Mm. But it has stuck. Even I saw Daniel Hagari, who is an IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces spokesperson, making a very pointed reference to, you know, the hostages not being lost and found. It was a case that they were taken from their homes, et cetera, et cetera. The Israeli president gave an interview to RTE then as well on Tuesday night, and again saying that Ireland is indifferent to Israeli pain, which I think is unfair. I think that there is obviously an affinity there between the Irish people and the Palestinian people, which is very obvious seeing the outreach we've seen and the compassion shown over time. But there does seem to be a level of, from the Israeli government point of view, probably thinking too much about what Ireland. The Irish government, isn't it?
I do wonder, is some of that coming from feedback from their people living here, though? Because when I speak to Israelis who live in Ireland, they would say very openly that they do feel, you know, nervous and kind of unsafe, you know, not just in the general way that a lot of people do in Dublin at the moment for other reasons, but that they feel sort of like they don't feel so comfortable here in Ireland, actually. And I wonder, does that feedback go back then through the channels? And is that where this comes from?
Some of it probably does, but I think it's more broadly, a lot of it, they see like Palestinian and Irish sort of solidarity on issues and, you know, Irish people waving Palestinian flags at things and they think that that's linked up. Remember that politician also made that point a few weeks ago, telling people in Gaza that they can go to the desert or they can go to Ireland, but they won't be staying in Gaza, which is effectively a threat of an ethnically cleansing Gaza of its people. So, there's clearly a very difficult issue. It's a very thorny issue, and it's very difficult to see a normalization of relations between Ireland and Israel. I know the Israeli president has said he's invited Leo Varadkar to visit Israel, which could be a starting point to that, a friendlier basis. But Ireland has been, and unapologetically, and I think broad range of support, even amongst all the parties, been one of the loudest voices in terms of saying that Israel has to stick to international humanitarian law and what it's doing in Gaza. And that is something which does seem to have been met with objection in Israel.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
We should talk about Katie Taylor, who pulled off something genuinely remarkable in the Three Arena on Saturday night. Not least because we came for so many years to just presume that Katie Taylor was effectively invincible anyway, because basically everything she touched would turn to gold. Then she had her defeat to Clarissa Shields earlier this year when she went up a weight class and fought another undisputed champion. And when you do that and you're 36 going on 37 years old as she now is, there's often a presumption that, well, you know, you're 37 now and you've just had a defeat, so you're, you know, you're probably past your best. She had a rematch against Clarissa Shields last Saturday night for Shields' undisputed championship at super lightweight. 64 kilos is her usual one, and she moved up a weight class. And she beat her, and she beat her relatively comfortably. One judge thought it was a draw. Nonsense. She beat her pretty comfortably and is now a unified, undisputed world boxing champion in two different weight divisions at the same time.
Wow.
Which is just...
That is
like, it's bizarre. Like, it's... We've become desensitized to how many barriers she breaks down. Like, we'll not appreciate her greatness until she isn't there anymore, because that's wild.
It is wild. Yeah, beating Chantel Cameron the other night, she was fairly written off in many ways, Katie Taylor, having lost her the first time around.
And was that just because of the age thing and she was getting a bit older and they didn't think maybe she could
Cameron is a bigger fighter. Yeah, she's a bigger fighter as well.
Having moved
bigger
up a weight class, it's always a big ask as well.
So, how old is Cameron? Is?
She's younger. She's a couple of years younger than her, but she's also taller and heavier. Which is natural advantages plus general age as well.
Yeah.
And is an incredible boxer in her own right. Mm. And again, the fact that it was a split decision shows that she's, you know, no slouch. It's very hard to beat somebody as motivated as Katie Taylor was on the night, especially as she says, she felt disrespected in the build up to it. Mm. But she was written off so much, even by the Irish press, who are always very good at getting behind our own people.
Dan, the director, tells us Chantal is 32.
She's 32. So yeah, five years
on her.
Significant.
Yeah.
Like, all eyes were already going to go to the fact they want a trilogy. Again, when she unified the lower weight class belts, I was like, just retire. Just retire undefeated. It'll be amazing. She's not that type of boxer to ever do this.
She loves it, though. She absolutely loves it. So loves it.
Totally. Her passion. And she's always wanted the Croke Park send-off as well, which obviously couldn't happen this time around or previously.
Remind us why it couldn't happen previously.
Why couldn't it happen?
Well, because again, at a remove, you kind of forget why it wasn't. But the concern at the time was that in the immediate aftermath of some of the heightened Hutch Kinahan gang violence, that because the Kinahan family is heavily involved in boxing promotion, that basically trying to police an event in Croke Park that might have 85, 90, 95,000 people there, because remember, you can fill all the stands and you can put seats on the pitch as well. So you can have an enormous number of people there, that policing that would be prohibitively expensive, and that they basically didn't think it was a runner to try and have that many people in the stadium for an event that could be sensitive. Now, maybe that threat might have subsided a little bit. I think everyone would love the sentimentality of giving Katie Taylor one final last hurrah and giving her the national occasion that it probably deserved, because last Saturday wasn't that until suddenly she won and people realised how brilliant she was.
But I do feel like did hear a lot of people talking about it in the run-up to it. Like, obviously I'm on the periphery of these things, but even I felt that it was quite a big deal, was it not, in the run-up?
Of course it was,
Was the run-up to this not much more muted than first time around, though?
But she didn't do interviews, you're saying. She's kind of, you know, she...
Yeah, there was a lot less in terms of actual press build-up to it. Now, there was the odd press conference, which Eddie Hearn, her promoter, was doing, and she was present at and whatnot. Yeah. A lot of questions.
He was on the AM.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he did the rounds, and he was asked actually some good questions by Conor McGregor as well, because he was co-sponsor, I think, of the fight in many ways, or at least his companies were, or whatever.
Yeah, Forged Irish Stout is one of the sponsors.
But yeah, I think it does set up an amazing, you know, it does look like they are set to do the trilogy. Chantel Cameron seems like an amazing athlete as well, incredible fighter. And I think there's a growing respect between the two of them now. Mm-hmm. They've had two absolute wars at this point to get to this. Chantel Cameron posted on Instagram saying, genuinely, thank you from the bottom of my heart to everyone who flew over to Ireland to come and support me, spending your well-earned money before Christmas. I appreciate it so much, but sorry, it wasn't the night everyone had planned, which is lovely. Really nice, really classy stuff. Nice. And it's amazing to see it happening in women's boxing at a time when men's boxing is kind of not in a brilliant spot either in the professional game. It is incredible. It is remarkable the things Katie Taylor has been able to do throughout a very long career at this point. Mm. If you go back all the way through the amateur ranks, everything she did at European and World Championship level, the Olympics, all the great times. And there has been knockbacks and there has been downsides as well, which is any great journey has to have its twists in it. She has not had it all her own way throughout that. She has not been indomitable and undefeated, which is stuff which matters to boxers, but she has been able to pick herself up so many times and been an incredible role model throughout as well, which is not something we should take for granted when it comes to sporting stars either. She has been absolutely remarkable all the way through.
And oh, she's been amazing. I loved, is it a documentary or a film, would you call it, Katie? The one that was made
kind
couple
of
years ago.
By Ross Whittaker.
It's a docu-film.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. If you haven't watched that, I mean, like, obviously now is the time to totally lean into that. I mean, she, to watch her razor sharp focus and to see just the drive that she has as an individual and to come back and to be so resilient, it's amazing. Yeah. I actually watched that documentary a couple of times. I really enjoyed it.
The drive that you would have seen in that then augmented because, you know, there was a real question mark over her future after her defeat earlier this year. So then to double down again and to be as classy and as pacey and the energy she brought like on Saturday night for somebody who a lot of people thought was past her prime was amazing. Which is one that just final reflection on Katie Taylor. I saw the IABA or one of the boxing associations tweet this afterwards. It is this century. It is within this century. It was 2001 that she participated in the very first officially sanctioned women's boxing match in Ireland in the National Stadium. That was as recent as 2001. And then look what she's done in the 10 years then up to London 2012 and in the 11 years since then, now being an undisputed champion in two weight classes at the same time.
It's incredible.
Like there was no sport for her to take up.
No, and
she's made it.
I think the point that you make, just want to finish on this, that about being really classy is such an important point because I think Katie Taylor has been unbelievably dignified throughout her career, hasn't she? She's really sort of come to the ring with such like enthusiasm, poise, and even in defeat, she's been really dignified and really classy in the outcome of all that. And so we wish her the best of luck. Do you think Croke Park will happen? Do we know? When will we know?
I think Croke Park says they haven't received contact about it yet.
Okay.
And there's a process
Somebody
there.
Somebody send the email. Let's find out if this is going to happen.
Let's get the ball rolling.
What's your favourite Girls Aloud song?
The Promise.
What a cold open.
Off the bat.
Really?
The Promise. There's great tunes. They actually, I was only on another podcast there the other day.
Our friend Dave's podcast. Give it a
No play. Encore. No Encore with Dave Hanratty.
We love it.
We were talking about pop bangers of the late 2000s. And Girls Aloud had an incredible run from when they got going through Pop Stars, The Rivals, I think it was, in 2002.
Oh, never forget.
No one ever remembers never the male lads they beat. Poor old One True Voice, written out of history.
It was a big comeback for Nadine Coyle after the whole Passport.
Also,
incident.
It was a big comeback for Girls Aloud because that format of Pop Stars that year, previously it was always just, let's find some person who's going to be Christmas number one. And that year was the one where they did two bands and they were competing against each other for Christmas number one.
Yeah.
And One True Voice were outselling them right up until the middle of the last week. And it was only a late
Your
comeback
is
by
so
Girls Aloud
unbelievably good.
That suddenly projected them into the band that they became. It's mad. How long are they? They're gone 10 years? Have they been inactive?
2011 is when they were apparently they split up. They had a decent shelf life for a pop group to get going from a 9-year run in a very commercial landscape.
But that makes me, because we were having a discussion earlier this week in the newsroom about, you know, when are you officially late 30s? And now that I'm 37, I think I am, alas. But like nothing.
Oh, it's your birthday. Happy birthday.
Thank you. Nothing makes you feel older, though, than the idea that like a band that you remember being big in your like teenage years is suddenly like on the comeback trail. And you're like, it doesn't feel like they were gone long enough for there to be that kind of level of nostalgia. But actually, no, their debut was like 20 years ago.
Oh,
yeah.
Sound of the Underground was 20 years ago.
2002.
Yeah.
That's my favourite Girls Aloud song,
Fire.
Sound of the Underground.
Great tune.
But then their cover of Jump, which
great.
Oh, yeah.
Like, so good. Mm. Like, just watched Love Actually. I was putting the tree up there the other day and was like, this song is a belter.
Yeah.
Oh, but that's the Pointer Sisters version, though, where Hugh Grant is doing the Christmas tree thing.
Oh, yeah, fair. Okay. Yeah. But still, their version's good.
Well, yeah, like, you say it's been a short time, Gav. Like, I think that is purely then the past evasion because Take That did their first big reunion in 2006. Mm. They don't have been gone.
Their first reunion was 2000.
Yeah,
their reunions were 17 years. Ago,
yeah, 2006, 2006, and they came back, So yeah,
he's putting his head down so everyone can see the ball.
So they were only gone 10 years. It's actually been a longer period of time, since Girls Aloud.
I feel like that Take That comeback era is longer now than their original.
They've had a couple of reunions as well, haven't they?
Yeah,
they have had a few.
Very impressive. Apparently, their stage show. Take That is
they're always worth
amazing,
seeing.
Yeah.
We make
I've
point
never
of going
seen
to
it.
In every show.
Have you watched the Robbie Williams thing on Netflix?
I saw the first episode. It was quite good.
I didn't know he had such a beef with Gary Barlow. I was like, did I miss that?
I think it was kind of notorious. I'm not all that in the loop on it, but
no,
I think it was fairly spicy, all right. Mm. But the Girls Aloud fever that I've seen across like Instagram today, the amount of people I know I've seen who've like posted up the Ticketmaster confirmation. Huge, so it's amazing. It's great to see.
Yeah. I mean, no, sorry, it is, but they were a different era, but I suppose I would have been more of a Spice Girls fan myself personally. Probably won't be rushing out to go to Girls Aloud, but I do, they are fab.
It's too many good gigs.
Bit of a pop factor trip. People never realise that Sugar Babes, that the name of Sugar Babes is a direct retort to the Spice Girls.
Mm.
I never knew that.
Sugar and spice. The babes and
girls. That is truly response. Yeah. Phenomenal.
Yeah.
Sugar babes are well loved at this point. Amazing. As well. They're doing amazing. Like, they do so many festivals. They did a very popular online, well, it's not just online, the house music EDM thing called Boiler Room, which does like DJ sets effectively around. And they're in the UK. They did one. They basically performed at it, which was a huge thing.
Wow.
So they are very much the top. So the girl group thing is very much back in sort of a stage of rebirth. At this
also,
point.
A group when you say feature. Boiler Room, I think of the Teenage Disco in Clonakilty, which is also called the Boiler Room back in the day.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a community hall.
Slightly suspect branding for a teenage event. Sugar Babes also, of course, in Love Actually. You've already broken your Love Actually tree.
Richard does not want to talk about the Christmas trees. He's going to not engage in the Christmas tree.
I'm just going to look at my phone for a while.
Totally. Sorry, but we used to put the tree up on your birthday, which is like...
That was during the pandemic.
The pandemic, fair enough.
So I think there was it was all bets were off at that point. Yeah.
I got the tree up on Monday. I'm absolutely thrilled. I can't even tell you. I love the tree. Mm. I've gone for a real tree again this year. Remember last year I was like, I'm going to a Christmas tree farm. I'm going to do the whole experience. So I did that and that was lovely.
I do recall though then you asking for our advice in like February as to at what point where you could dispose of a Christmas tree at that point.
What happened to me
all the Christmas tree facilities have closed, Sarah. It's
so
February.
By the time I went to take the tree down, because I loved it so much, I hung on to the tree till like mid-January. And then it was really unfortunate actually when I phoned up to have the tree taken away. They had just finished the tree removal thing like the day before. And like, the poor lady, I was like, please, surely you have like one van that will come and take this tree away. And I had to beg her. And then they came out and took it. But
they actually did in the end. Okay.
They did, but it took me 2 days of groveling on the phone to some woman to get her to come and take my tree away. So you got yours up.
Yeah, unusually early, because we would ordinarily wait until this weekend coming. But I thought what we were doing last Sunday, that just the idea struck us that we were all just at home for the afternoon. We said, you know what, let's just do it now.
But your birthday was on Monday, so it was nice to have the tree up for the birthday.
No, see, ordinarily we would wait until after my birthday has been and gone, because that was our childhood tradition in home. Okay. That we would always wait until my birthday was out of the woods and it was basically December, and then we'd put it up. But this time we just said, you know what, we'll do it. But it's nice. The house just does feel kind of cozier.
It does feel
cozier.
Nicer, yeah.
It's nicer.
Now, I'm not going to lie. Our tree is, I love our tree. It's probably a bit thicker and it's probably taken up more space in the room than I'd like to admit. But like, it'll start to wilt over the next couple of
weeks. As long as you do get rid of it in the first week of January, like a regular citizen, and not just wait and have to
I think he probably will. I mean, I think he's better at those things than me. Okay, so I think he'll probably sort it out. But are you going to put one up?
I will, yeah. I just haven't felt festive yet. Obviously, everything that happened last week is probably not exactly all that festive.
You'll get there.
Okay,
if we're just wrapping up, I'd like to thank everybody who has shared their Spotify Wrapped. Our Spotify Wrapped.
I must be up here now while we're
because a lot of people shared their top podcasts in which we feature for some people, which is very nice. So it's always nice to see that. So this marketing ploy by Spotify has absolutely worked on us and we're delighted that it has worked.
Thank you.
But thanks everybody for taking the time. To listen to the podcast.
Yes, thank you. And we will be with you again next week. Thank you very much, news correspondent Richard Chambers, digital correspondent Gavin Riley. Have a good one, guys. We'll talk to you soon. The documentary Thursday night.
10:15.
See
you then. Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.